Good morning and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Larry Kay. I'm calling from Chicago, and I'm going to be the host for the presentation today. Today is Sunday, January 4th, 2026. Let me give you the share ID numbers for Friday, January 2nd. They are the following for the 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time meeting. That number is 23,081. That's 23081. And for the 10 a.m. meeting on Friday, 23,082, that's 23082. This morning, A Vision for You presents, I Am Wondering, a big book Q&A. So Harlan's going to briefly share on his remarkable story of transformation as the result of the 12 steps. And then we're going to quickly transition into a big book 12-step Q&A. So just a very brief lead in, you know, human beings have, it seems, extraordinary capabilities, and we come here with extraordinary capabilities, although we're dealing with this disease, and we're capable of cognition. I mean, that's a huge one. We think, and with that capability, we can do some miraculous, I've seen you do some miraculous things. Now we can analyze, we can examine things, we can discern, we can recognize differences. We can contemplate. We can consider. And those are amazing things. And you'll use all of those abilities as you navigate through the 12 steps. But I do want to tell you something, and that is that nothing contributes more to your ability to have a psychic change, a spiritual awakening sufficient to stop this disease in its tracks than action. We have to take massive, determined action. And our namesake is A Vision for You. And you know, I'll tell you something about vision. Vision without action is just a daydream. Yet as the big book reminds us, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed this path. And one's willingness to accept what this path is versus what this path is not makes all the difference in the world. And joining us this morning to share his experience with transformation, a spiritual transformation, is Harlan G. He's from the mean streets of Scottsdale, Arizona. Harlan has carried this message of recovery all over the globe over four decades. He's dedicated to the 12 steps and the 12 traditions as a way of life. And it's with tremendous gratitude that we welcome Harlan to the line this morning. Good morning, buddy. How are you doing?
Good morning, Larry. Thank you so much. I certainly appreciate your lead-in, and thank you for the kind words. I am Harlan G. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater, and although I do live in Scottsdale, Arizona, I am born and raised in the city of Chicago. And you can take the boy out of Chicago, but you can't take Chicago out of the boy. I'm very, very glad to be here. I have been a compulsive overeater with a tremendous problem of this food addiction from the day I was born. I have been witnessed to doctors screaming and yelling at my mother and at my father from the time I was 3, 4 years old, 5 years old, screaming at them, how could you let this kid get so fat? What are you feeding this kid? Why are you letting him eat candy? Why are you letting him eat cake? Why are you letting him eat whatever? You know, whatever it was a problem. And then when I turned about 5 or 6, they started screaming directly at me, and they started giving me diets to follow. Why were all the diets pink? Did you ever notice if you're anywhere close to my age, all the diets that the doctors gave you were written in pink? But anyway, I grew up as a fat kid, definitely as a fat kid, and this disease took its toll on me. It wreaked havoc into my life. I can remember distinctly when I was a little boy, John F. Kennedy was the president of the United States, and he started a fitness program for children, and so the gym teachers were required by law to time you in the 50-yard dash, and you had to do pull-ups, and you had to do sit-ups, and oh boy, that was just torture for me. And the other your kids got timed in the 50-yard dash with a stopwatch, and jokingly they said they're going to time Harlan with a calendar. And I just couldn't run that 50-yard dash in any kind of respectable time, that's for sure. And I remember when I was 9 years old. 9 years old, Dr. Jacobson put me on very heavy amphetamine diet pills, very heavy amphetamines. And this disease wreaked havoc on me. Those pills did a number on my brain. My God, these amphetamines. You sleep about 20 minutes a month. And, you know, you're privy, you're catching every cold, every flu, because you're never sleeping. You're never able to recharge your battery. And so I was privy to every cold and strep throat and everything you could possibly imagine. By the time I was a teenager, this disease had emasculated me physically and emasculated me emotionally. And this disease wreaked havoc on me. And then as I entered puberty, I was on the outside looking in so many ways. I was on the outside looking in as my friends were dating and my friends were, you know, playing games and things that I couldn't do, and I couldn't run very fast, I couldn't jump very high, and I was left out of so much of life. I'm going to try to make this short, which is not characteristic of me, because I want to get to the questions and answers. To make a long story short, though, my mother and father were both dying teenager. And as I was a senior at Mather High School in Chicago, Illinois, on the north side, I was 335 pounds as a senior in high school. And my life expectancy was not good. Doctors said to me and said to my mother that I would never live to see 30, that I would just, you know, my weight was 335, and they said he's not going to live very long. And I remember my mother was crying her eyes out, he's going to die. And I remember the both of us stopping for ice cream on the way home to assuage our feelings of me dying. But I'm still alive, and I'm 71, which is fantastic, and I'm healthy, and that's great. It's been a long journey. I don't want to go into every little detail now, as I say, because I want to get to the Q&A. But my parents were dying when I was a teenager, and I don't have brothers and sisters. I'm an only child. I didn't really have anybody to lean on but my wonderful friends, and sometimes their parents would help me with different decisions and different things. They would step in and help me. My mother died when I was 22. My father died when I was 24, and I was off to the races, just tremendous. I was 700 pounds by the time this disease started to subside in me because of the spiritual awakening. But the bottom line is that I couldn't get in and out of a car. I was in my 20s. I could barely walk. I couldn't stand. I became an object of ridicule. I would go out into the world and I would go to a grocery store and children would laugh at me and adults would laugh at me and people would come up to me and grab my stomach or grab my butt and they would grab me and they would say, hey, when's the baby hippopotamus due? And I didn't even know these people, and they're touching me and they're saying very invasive, hurtful things to me, like, do you know how fat you are? Do you know what a spectacle you are? And I didn't even know them. And I thought the best thing for me to do would be to die. The best result would be is if I could get my stomach full of Doritos and just die, because I didn't know how to live with the food and I didn't know how to live without the food. There was no way for me to live. I could exist, but I couldn't live. I couldn't stand. I couldn't sit. I broke furniture. I lived in one pair of pants and a couple of shirts that couldn't be buttoned with any type of anything. They were 7 extra large shirts, and I wore T-shirts underneath them that had cigarette burns and food stains all over them. I looked and smelled like a sight, and I smelled like a trip to the zoo or a park district bathroom. My hygiene was not being practiced. I didn't brush my teeth. I just didn't care. I didn't give a damn. I was defeated by life. This disease had me in its grip, and it was the most unmerciful, unrelenting, brutal, murder. The Yiddish word of the day could be merdelechazach, which is a murderous thing. This disease was a merdelechazach, an umglick in my life, and I didn't have any way to shake it. An umglick is a curse. It technically means bad luck, but it's a curse. And I didn't have any way to shake off this disease. My father died in November of 1979. And on November of 78, and on February 2nd, 1979, just weeks after my father's passing, my surrogate mother, who just passed away this past year, came into my home and pushed her way past the pizza boxes, the Twinkie wrappers, the Hostess cupcake wrappers. She pushed her way past the Oreo cookie bags. She pushed her way past all the mouse droppings and all the other filth and squalor that I was living in, and literally dragged me physically to a meeting on a Friday night in Skokie, Illinois, at the Orchard Mental Health Center. Orchard Mental Health Center. See, God likes to laugh too. And February 2nd, 1979, I attended my first meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. I hated the meetings. I was 30 years younger than anybody in that room. I looked around and I didn't wonder what I was doing there, but I wondered why you were there. You were much thinner than me. I outweighed anybody in that room by at least 300-400 pounds. And you looked pretty normal to me. You had sex and you were married and you were wearing nice clothes and you had nice jobs. Couldn't figure for the life of me what you were doing there. Lots and lots of things happened, and here I'll summarize by saying this. On December the 20th, which just occurred a few days ago, I celebrated my 27th year of abstinence. I've lost a little over 500 pounds. So much has happened to me in the 46 years since I came into this program, it would fill volumes. I couldn't do it in the time allotted here to tell you the changes in my life. On page 63 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, "We were reborn." Let me assure you that the voice you are listening to coming from me, if any similarity between me and the person that came in here February of 1979 is purely coincidental. The things that have happened, the miracles that I have seen, the miracles that I didn't see for years, and the miracles that remain undetected by me are astronomical. I am the child of a loving, merciful God today, and I beautifully embrace every single day of life. I beautifully embrace every molecule of life, every cell of life today, and I want to live. I can't wait to do service. I can't wait to live my life. I've had a tough year. I had a lot of loss in 2025. Three deaths and the loss of someone else in my life made 2025 a very, very difficult year for me. Very difficult. And you know what? I'm still alive and I'm still abstinent and I haven't taken solace in food. This is the greatest way of life imaginable. This is the most fantastic, easier, softer way ever devised by God and mankind. This is the greatest program in the world. Before I close my part out and we open with Q&A, I just want to thank the person that brought me to my first meeting. May she rest in peace. I want to thank Leah and Melanie, Amy and Katie for their part in Vision. I want to thank Roseanne S. And I want to just hope that each and every one of you will enjoy the miracles and the abundance of God that I have seen and witnessed in my life in the ensuing 46 years since I first came into this program. Miracles are not reserved for me. Miracles are not reserved for the chosen few. There is a miracle for you. Many, 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 many miracles for you. Just keep going. Keep doing what you're doing. If you're in recovery, if you're not, if you need to change something, do what you need to do, because you will see miracles beyond your wildest dreams. Don't quit 5 minutes before the miracles happen. Stay the course. Do what you need to do. All right. I've lost a little over 500 pounds. I told you that. I've got 27 years of abstinence. Larry, let's open it up for questions and answers.
That sounds great, Harlan. Thanks so much. So we're going to, this is entitled, I Was Wondering. What are you wondering about with regard to the big book, The 12 Steps, Our Practical Program of Spiritual Action? If you have a question for Harlan, we're just going to ask no questions about three things. Food.
Three?
Three. Oh, you wait for it, Harlan.
Okay.
No questions about food.
No.
Right? What else? No questions about math.
No math.
And no questions about the Green Bay Packers.
No questions about the Green Bay Packers. And the Milwaukee Brewers,
right.
For sure. Yeah, we hate them.
Okay,
sure.
So we'll extend it to them and the White Sox and so forth. But if you have a question for Harlan, press
all
star
right.
One. Give me your first name, and let's line up here. Who's got a question for Harlan?
Who's got a question?
Meg S.
Meg? Who else?
Emmy.
Was
Liberty.
That Penny?
Joe M. Minnesota.
Gotcha, Joe. I heard Meg, Penny. I don't know if that was Liba, if I heard that right, or something along those
lines. Liba,
yeah, Liba
G. Krista S.
Say that one again.
Krista S.
Jessica. Gotcha, Jessica. Who else?
Krista.
Oh, Krista? Was it Krista?
Krista. Yep, K-R-I-S-T-A.
Gotcha.
Thank you.
Gotcha, Krista. I got Meg, Penny, Liba, Joe, Krista so far. Who else?
Chanel T.
Hi, Chanel. Gotcha.
Catherine K.
Catherine. Gotcha. Anybody
Alexis
else?
Alexis F.
Gotcha, Alexis.
Elizabeth G.
And gotcha, Elizabeth. And I heard Herbert in the background, I believe.
Yes, Herbert.
Gotcha, Herbert.
Marisa G.
Marisa. Anybody else? Okay. Let's stop for the moment and we'll get through these and then we'll see where we are on time. Hopefully we'll be good and you can get in from there. So I heard Meg, Penny. I think it was Liba, but you'll get me.
Larry, I'm not hearing you. Hello. Uh-oh.
Okay, I was muted there. So
right.
Let me give you the list again. Meg, Penny, Liba, Joe, Krista, Chanel, Catherine, Alexis, Elizabeth, Herbert, and Marissa. If you're not Meg, if you would remute. And Meg, go ahead with our first question for Harlan this morning. Meg, press star one.
Meg, star one.
Hello?
Okay.
Yeah, there we go.
Hi, I am Meg S. from Missouri, recovering on step 7. Thank you so much for your share and your service. I was wondering about your practice of increasing humility in and also praying for the removal of your and practicing the removal of your or being removed your character defects. How did you do it?
By working the steps.
Thank you.
I basically just do it by working the steps. I work the steps, obviously, every day. I sponsor others, and I'm very, very diligent at my 11 steps. I'm very diligent at my 12 step, my 10 steps, and that's how I do it. I pray to have my defects removed. Defects will never really be removed. They're temporarily alleviated, but they will never be permanently eradicated because the ego resurrects itself just gorgeously. As Clancy Imeslin teaches us, no matter how evolved my recovery gets, I will never rise above the level of a human being. And as a human being, I'm going to want something, and maybe I can have it, and maybe I can't have it. But if I have it, then I don't want it taken away. And if I can't have it, then I'm going to be, I'm going to be hurt. So I pray to have my defects removed. I work steps 10, 11, and 12 every single day. And as I work step 10, and as I work step 11, I also work 4 through 12 every single day, and that is my process of asking God to remove my defects, and that is how I maintain humility.
Thanks, Meg,
for the question.
Okay. Yeah, next up we have Penny, followed by, if I got it right, Leba, but you'll correct me if I'm wrong, Leba. Penny, it's your turn. Good morning. Penny, we're not hearing you. Star one.
Hi, it's actually Emmy, but it might have sounded like Penny. Thanks for your service, and I loved listening to you, Harlan. So my question is that the most I've been abstinent is 30 days. I work the steps, and then I keep flipping. I'm still here because I know this is where I need to be, so I keep coming back, keep doing the work, and restarting the steps. And I know the thing is that I just, in those moments, how would I use, like, the big book? Like, is it just making those calls? Because I'm just starting to get really down and keep going back to step one, but I'm willing to do whatever it takes. I'm just wondering if you had any advice on that.
Well, I have a lot of experience on that because that was my story, and this is what happened to me. I would get 30 days, and then I would go back and so on. And what I learned is that is not indicative of working the steps. I wasn't really working the steps. That's not true. I was giving myself the illusion that I was working the steps, but I was not. When I worked the steps, I got a lot longer than 30 days, let me tell you. What I was doing at that moment was I was dieting with group support. In other words, I was using my unaided willpower to fend off the urge to eat for as long as I could. And usually, as you're describing, 30 days in, I would eat because life just got too lifey for me. So here is what had to happen. The first thing I had to come to the conclusion is that if nothing changes, nothing changes. And if I want different, I've got to do different. And unless I'm willing to do different, nothing is going to change. Nothing is going to change. And I had to have a come to Harlan meeting with myself and God. And I had to say to myself, what is it that I want with the one life that I have? What is it that I want? Because I kept thinking, I'm just going to die anyway. What is the point of all this? I can't possibly live as fat as I am. I can't possibly walk. I can't get in and out of a car. I can't function as a human being. What is the point of living? And I had to say to myself, this is not a dress rehearsal. And Emmy, I mean this from the bottom of my heart. I was only giving myself the illusion that I was working the steps, but there is something that I did have to review, and that was my food. Now, I don't like talking about food because it's extremely controversial, so I'm just going to talk about me. I'm not going to talk about you. I had to look at every single thing that was going in my mouth. And I had to look for sugar and all of its various guises, malt barley and corn syrup and corn starch and maltose and dextrose. And I had to look at every single thing that I was putting in my mouth, because if I'm going to continue to fire up that physical allergy, there is no way that I'm not going to place myself beyond human aid. I had to review everything. And all, in OA, there are fashionable things that went through OA. And when I was young in OA, when I was new in OA, people would say, well, if it's the fifth ingredient or this, that doesn't apply to me. I have a very sensitive allergy. No sugar can enter into my mouth without danger being fraught. So I had to look at everything. I also changed sponsors. I also had to make changes in my life. I had to dedicate myself to this, and I had to...
Hey, Harlan, press star one. The line was muted there, so we're not hearing you, so go ahead.
Okay, did I get muted there? I don't know where you lost.
Yes.
I had to say...
Just a second ago.
Okay, I had to... Thanks for letting me know. I had to say to myself, is this the number one thing in my life, or am I kidding myself? And the number one thing in my life has to be recovery. Now, I don't live to recover. I recover to live. But recovery has to be numeral uno. It cannot be the only thing in my life, or I'm not going to have much of a life. I have to make it number one, though. And what I had to stop doing was I had to stop kidding myself that I was doing the program. I was not doing the program. If I was doing the program, I was able to put together a lot more than 30 days. I was able to do the things that others do to recover. I did the things, that's better. I did the things others did. And I had to be asked by a sponsor, if you want what they have, I have to do what they do. And when I did what they did, I got beautiful results. And for the last 27 years, I have not found it necessary to compulsively overeat. And this is what I found out in closing, Emmy. If this is not a program for people who need it. This is not a program for people who want it. This is a program for people who do it. And unless I was going to do it, I am just going to keep going 30 days, 20 days, 50 days. And eventually I'm going to die. So I hope that helps, but that was my history around exactly what you're asking me.
Thanks for the question, Annie. Okay, next up is, I believe, Liba. If I mispronounce that, you'll help me. And then Joe.
My mother's middle name.
Liba?
Thank you. Yeah. Liba G in Florida.
Okay.
Thank you, Larry. And hi, Harlan. Thank you for your tremendous service here. On page 25, Roman numeral, the doctor's opinion. The subject presented in this book seems to me to be of paramount importance to those afflicted with alcoholic addiction. The question I'm asking, what we say compulsive eating, compulsive overeating, to me, compulsive is like a psychological term. And the affliction for me is food addiction. And I'm just curious why we all say compulsive eating in this community. And I
because
don't.
Because that's what Roseanne, that's how we started. Don't get hung up in words. Don't get hung up in words. If whatever words, whether it's these words, whether it's that, if that works better for you, do it. But Roseanne and the early OAers, back in January of 1960, January 19th, 1960 was the first meeting of OA. They named it Overeaters Anonymous, and they called themselves compulsive overeaters. And this tradition or this custom has been passed down, and that's how we identify ourselves today. And that's where that started.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Liba. Hey, before we go to Joe, Harlan, what was it like meeting Roseanne when you met her?
Roseanne was a firehouse. She was a firecracker. She was a Jewish woman, very short in stature, but very long in control and character. She was a character, and she very strong personality. We went to the same grammar school at different times, but we went to Clinton Grammar. I went to Green School for K through 6, and then Clinton Grammar School for 7th and 8th because Green only went up to 6th grade. She went to Clinton too because we lived, basically, she moved from Milwaukee. Her father was Glass. I forgot his first name, but he was a big muckety-muck in B'nai B'rith. and she went to Clinton Grammar School, and that was how I sort of connected with her. We both went to the same school. But she was a firecracker. She was an absolute firecracker, very strong, very strong-willed, and she got us going. And there are many detractors of Roseanne. Roseanne, at times, had a lot of people rubbed the wrong way, but there is something that you cannot, and she did slip and slide with the food. She wasn't on board necessarily with this God business. She fought that. She wanted to change the steps. Thank God Clancy Imeslin talked her out of that. But she got us going, and it was her strength and her fortitude that started Overeaters Anonymous, and it was her strength and her fortitude that kept it going. And thank God for Roseanne S., because if it wasn't for Roseanne S., I don't know that we'd be here today, and I would certainly be dead. So thank you, Roseanne S. in heaven. You got us going, and you know what? We owe you a great deal of gratitude. Absolutely.
Thanks, Harlan. Thanks for indulging
Absolutely.
Me. Joe, yeah. Your turn, Joe. Start to step on your opportunity.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Larry, and thank you, Harlan. There are some passages in the Big Book that I sincerely do not understand. I'm not trying to overthink it, but I'm not trying to overthink these passages. I sincerely don't understand them, and I'd be interested in what your thoughts were. The first one is in the doctor's opinion on page 28, Roman numeral 28.
Okay.
It says, the sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the And I don't know what he means by the true
okay.
from the false. I don't
Let's
understand
examine
that one.
Let's
okay.
examine that one, Joe, because I always love your shares, by the way. But the bottom line is this paragraph, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. If this book were a building, this paragraph would be its cornerstone, because this paragraph is paramount to our understanding. So let's clear this up for you. When he says the sensation is so elusive, now let's take a look at what he's talking about. He's talking about the effect. He's not necessarily talking about the allergy at this point. He's talking about the effect of the food. What is the effect? Let's determine that. It is that sense of ease and comfort that comes instantly by taking certain foods into my body. And for about 9 seconds, when I'm eating M&Ms with peanuts, I feel fantastic. The problem is that feeling is very, very short-lived, and it doesn't last very long. But when he is talking, and this is more to your point, Joe, that we cannot tell the true from the false, we are telling ourselves, this time, it's going to be different. This time, when I eat cake, when I eat cookies, it's going to be okay. I'm just going to have a slice of cake, and I'm going to be able to stop. And every single time from the day I was born, I take a slice of cake, and I'm off to the races. So when he is referring to it being we cannot differentiate between the true and the false, he's saying we admit that we're hurting ourselves, it's injurious, but this time it's going to be okay, and every single time it's not okay. Now, when he says we can't differentiate the true from the false, does that mean I think today is Tuesday, or do I think today is August whatever? No, it means every single time I imbibe in certain foods, I am going to run into trouble. Yes, I'm going to feel fantastic for about 9 seconds, but then the awful allergy is going to be triggered, and I am going to eat a lot more food than I had originally intended. So specifically, again, when he says that they cannot tell the different, they cannot differentiate the true from the false, that means I know I'm hurting myself, but I'm going to fool myself into thinking this time it's going to be okay, and it never is. I hope that helps. Is there anything else while we have you on the line?
Yeah, I did have one other passage
that
I didn't understand. Okay, so it's in the section on step 11 on page 87.
Page 87, give me a second to get there. Give me a second. Okay, I'm on. I'm there.
Oh, okay. It's the first full. Well, it's not the whole paragraph, but the first sentence of the first full paragraph. He says, "We usually conclude the period of meditation with a prayer that we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be, that we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems." Why does he use the word problems?
The reason he's using the word problems is he is this is pure Oxford group, by the way. This paragraph is repeated on page 13, almost verbatim, almost verbatim. And when this paragraph was originally written, Hank Parkhurst put in the margin, "This is real groupy. Are you sure you want these words?" But anyway, let's take a look at what we have here. It says that we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be, that we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. When he's talking about the problems, he's talking about the irritations that we run into as human beings during our day. As he's talking about, we be shown all through the day what our next step is to be. This is an indication that we are working steps all the time, that we be given whatever we need to take care of such problems. When we are to be given whatever we need, that means from God. God, how am I going to overcome the fact that this person, let's call him Fred, is at my office and Fred and I just butt heads all the time. Now I'm in a meeting with Fred and we're butting heads again. How am I going to get through this problem? Probably step 10, probably step 4 if it keeps, occurring and occurring and occurring. But the problems are the things we face as human beings that our defects of character, that challenge our egoism into thinking, I'm right, I know I want to write the script, nobody else is following my script. So I'm going to use self-seeking, which is manipulation. I'm going to lie, I'm going to do whatever I need to do to manipulate so that I can get my way. These are the problems that he's talking about. And often these problems manifest at such a fast rate, we don't even know that we're in the mix again. And the only solution becomes eating. So the problems are the daily challenges. Then it says, we ask especially for freedom from self-will and are careful to make no requests for ourselves only. So the problems he's talking about are the vicissitudes of life, the challenges of life.
Okay, that's great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. Harlan, you heard the three C's?
Three C's.
Krista, Chanel, and Catherine. Hey,
Krista is with a K, I think.
Oh, it's with a K, darn it. Okay.
Yeah, Krista, Chanel, and Catherine. I think Catherine is with a K, too.
Look at that. Two K's and a C. Hey, Krista, it's your turn. Good morning.
Good morning. Harlan, thank you so much. Your story is unbelievable, genuinely. How did you fully surrender?
I had no choice. When I fully surrendered on December the 29th, 1998, it was October of 1998, and it was the week of Halloween. And Halloween that year in 1998 was on a Saturday night. And on Friday night, there was a Halloween celebration at my daughter's little school. We were living in Eugene, Oregon at that time. My daughter was 4 years old, and she did not want me to go to her Halloween dinner. There was a spaghetti dinner there, and I was in complete relapse, probably around 500 pounds at that time. I was bouncing back off a massive weight loss and going up and up and up and up. And she didn't want me to come because she was embarrassed that the other kids, the teachers, and the parents of the kids would see how fat I am, and she did not want me to come. That was a very tough pill to swallow. And I saw that I was hurting my wife and I was hurting my child. And there was college football on that Friday night, and I couldn't even pay attention to it. And I love college football. I couldn't even pay attention to it. I was hurting. And I said to myself, it's one thing to hurt yourself, which is an illusion. You're always hurting other people too. You know what they say, every addict takes seven people to hell with them. But this has got to stop. I know what to do. There was no OA in Eugene, Oregon. There's no such thing. Maybe there is now. There wasn't when I lived there. There was no such thing. And I went to the AA groups. I will always be indebted to the New Freedom Group in Eugene, Oregon on Coburg Road. They welcomed me with open arms. I started attending their meetings right after that occurred. And they welcomed me. And we had a Great Pyrenees at that time, which is, if you don't know what a Great Pyrenees is, take a St. Bernard and dye it white, and that's a Great Pyrenees. And I used to walk through the neighborhood with my dog, and I went to the meeting, and a guy says, hey, the guy with the white dog is here. And I knew I could find a home there then. There was somebody there that was, you know, familiar with me or something. I started going to AA meetings at that time because, again, as I say, we were in Eugene. There's no such thing as OA in Eugene, Oregon. It doesn't exist. It didn't then. And on December the 29th, 1998, I was abstinent to the point where I was satisfied that this could be the day I could call it abstinent. I consumed no sugar. I had no overeating, no volume, no nothing. And that was my day one, was December the 29th. And my daughter and my wife, my wife and I did divorce in 2010. My wife fell in love with somebody else, and that did occur. But I did surrender because I could see how much I was hurting them. And it was the greatest miracle of my life, was to surrender to God, surrender to a loving and merciful God. But that's the story of how that happened. I could see the pain on my little daughter's face, and she looks just like my father. She speaks English where he didn't, and she doesn't smoke Chesterfields, but she's him. She has his sense of humor. She has his mannerisms. She's a dead ringer for my dad. She looks more like him than I do. So I couldn't let that go on anymore, and that's what happened.
Hey, Krista, thanks for that question. You bet. Next up, we have Chanel, followed by Catherine. Chanel, good morning.
Chanel number five.
Good morning. Thank you for your service, Larry, and thank you always for all your service. Harlan, I mean, wow. And your story is... it's powerful. Thank you. Hi, I'm Chanel. I have a little bit of a frog in my throat this morning. Chanel T. in Washington State, grateful and recovered compulsive eater today by the grace of God. Hopefully my question will make sense. I'll give you a little bit of context. People go on trips. People have a crisis. People have surgery. People go see family. People go to an OA retreat. They've worked the steps. They've worked them abstinently, and they do great while they're there through the crisis, through the hospitalization, through the treatment, the retreat, seeing family, whatever it is. They come home, and on that re-entry, they relapse. You and I have heard these stories. You've heard them many more years than I have. But I'm just wondering what Harlan G. has been doing with programs so that that does not happen to you, and what you would suggest.
Now for the question. It's good to hear your voice. Reentry into the world can be very difficult. I hate walking into my empty house. You know, you come in, and there's nobody wearing name badges, and there's nobody hugging you, and there's nobody making a big deal over you. There's nobody, you know, celebrating OA, and there's nobody whatever. You're walking into a different world. And one of the things that I'm reminded of is I'm reminded of a story that took place in New Jersey. And it took place as I was doing a retreat, and there was a woman there, and she said to me, can I call you after I work the steps? And I said, no. And she looked at me like I was the purple people eater, like I had three heads. Why not? I said, because you're never done working the steps, and there's no phone in the casket, so you can't call me when you're done. But let's take a look at two things very, very quickly. Let's take a look at page 84. And on page 84, there's a paragraph which begins, "This thought brings us to step 10. And let's take a look at a word, continue, that appears four times in this paragraph. Continue to take personal inventory. Continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. It should continue for our lifetime. Continue to watch." And let's take a look at one of the pitfalls that we fall into as compulsive overeaters. The symbol of Alcoholics Anonymous is an equilateral triangle surrounded by a circle. What does the circle represent? The circle represents perpetuity. And if I am going to walk into my house after a trip, or I'm going to walk into my house after a retreat or a convention, the birthday is coming up. I'm going. I hope you are too. And we're going to be at the birthday, or we're going to be at a retreat, or we're going to be at a meeting, or we're going to be at whatever a trip to the dentist could trigger it too. And we walk into the house, what are we charged with doing? We are charged with taking action. And the food going in the mouth is not the beginning of the relapse. It is the culmination of prelapse. What is prelapse? Prelapse is the cessation of action necessary to maintain recovery. Prelapse is the sense of is the cessation, the stopping of action that we need to take to be in recovery. So when that urge hits me to eat ice cream or eat something innocent like tuna fish or something innocent like God knows what, grapefruit, whatever, and it's not appropriate for me to be eating that or that amount of it, I am charged with taking action. I said before, not a program for people who need it. It's not a program for people who want it. It's a program for people who do it. I must at that point go for the phone and say, I need reentry. I'm not adjusting well. Talk to me for a minute. And pray. And take that phone call, and if I have to, make another and another and another, but do whatever I need to do not to put the food in my mouth. Because the key to this is not to put the food in my mouth, but to take action. And in that action comes recovery. And what I need to remember is every single time I do anything, I am either going to God or I am going toward the food. There's no middle ground. There's a reverse and a drive. Reverse and drive. There's no park. There's no neutral. There's no low. There's nothing. So if I'm walking into my house after a retreat, a trip to the dentist, a convention, a meeting, a trip to the gas station, and I want to eat, I have to take action. Preventative action. And that preventative action starts with prayer, and then it translates out into a phone call. And today, it is easier to recover than it has ever been. You have phone numbers in Brazil. You have phone numbers in Italy, in Greece, in Scotland, in England, in Israel. You have phone numbers that you can access through WhatsApp, where you can call the entire world and it will cost you nothing. When I came into this program, there was no such thing as free long distance. Are you kidding me? There was no such thing. Today, it is easier to recover than it has ever been. It is only a matter of doing the action. Whether I'm willing to do it or not, I have to take that action. And if I take that action, when I walk to God, God will run to me. I have never made a couple of outreach calls when I've wanted to eat where the food went in my mouth. Never. Every time I walk to God, God runs to me. He is unfailing and unflinching in his benevolence. And that's what we have to do. We have to continue to take action. I hope that helps, Chanel.
Thanks, Chanel. Okay, next up we have Catherine followed by Alexis. Catherine, good morning to you. Catherine, press star one. Okay, maybe Catherine, maybe she's having some technical difficulties. Alexis, how about you? Can you press star
Alexis.
One? Have a question for us?
Yes, Larry, I'm here. Thank you. Harlan, I'd like to ask you, well, first of all, I remember my favorite story about Roseanne was there was a convention and they said, "Where's our founder, Roseanne? Would you please stand up?" And she waved. She was in the back serving coffee. And my favorite Joan Rivers joke was Mary dressed so trumpily, so frumpy, that I dress her in Chanel. And I wanted to ask, with the 10th step, one sponsor told me that I could start telling it to God alone without telling it to another person. And how do you agree with that or not?
I do. I completely disagree with it. I completely disagree with it. The big book is very, very clear. Number one, it says here in the 10th step, continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. Now, here's again. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. We discuss new sentence. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. That's number one. What does it say on page 72 here? I believe it's 72. Let's take a look. It says here on page 72 that a solitary self-appraisal proved insufficient. Now, how are you going to discuss your 10th step if you're just doing it by yourself? Can you give yourself, if you're anything like me, I'm going to talk about me, I don't want to talk about you. I cannot give myself objectivity. I cannot give myself fresh viewpoints. My broken brain cannot overcome my broken brain. It is very, very clear that a solitary self-appraisal proved insufficient. I discuss it with another person at once. Why do I do that? Because the other person has a fresh perspective, they're more objective about it, and I think doing it to myself, by myself, defeats what God's intentions were on step 10. That's my opinion.
Thanks,
okay, thank you, Harlan.
You're welcome.
Okay, we'll go back. Was there a Catherine? If not, we'll move on to Elizabeth. Catherine, we'll give you a chance to press star one.
There was a Catherine because I wrote it down too. There definitely was, and then she said it was with a K.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, that's
what
I thought.
Happened, but there was a Catherine.
All right.
You
well, there may be some problems.
On.
Elizabeth? Okay. Yeah, no problem. Elizabeth, followed by Herbert. Elizabeth, press star one.
Hi, Larry. Can you hear me?
Yep.
I can. You bet.
Okay. Hi. Hello to you both. Thank you both for your service to Elizabeth D., recovered compulsive overeater in Massachusetts. Larry, thank you. Thank you so much, Larry, for asking about Roseanne, and thank you, Harlan, for your answer. That was so illuminating. My question for you, Harlan, is, and this is, I'm risking an outside issue, but I'm not sure if it is an outside issue. You can tell me if it is. I'm reading Wally Patton's book about two-way prayer, and I'd love to hear any thoughts you have about that whole process and where it fits in historically, but also in terms of daily practice.
If two-way prayer works for you, do it. If two-way prayer doesn't work for you, don't do it. It is a matter of personal preference, and there is nothing in the big book, there is nothing in our literature that suggests you must or must not use two-way prayer. So, again, if it is something that works for you, fantastic. Go for it. If it's not, don't. I mean, there's really nothing in the literature that says do it or don't.
Okay. Thanks.
Nothing at all.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Yeah, you bet.
Sure.
Okay. How about a question from Herbert followed by Marissa? Herbert?
Good morning. Thank you, Harlan. This is Herbert. You've been a great mentor to me for the last number of years, for many, many reasons. So My question is about sponsorship. I have a sponsee who had been 4 days abstinent. We were studying the big book with the doctor's opinion and Bill's story. And in the last 2 days, she sent me a text message that says, Herbert, I can't talk to you now. I can't talk to you today because my son-in-law is in the hospital. I can't talk to you. So how would you respond to that?
I would respond to that by saying we have a very serious problem. I don't belittle the fact that your son-in-law is in the hospital. I understand that. I've been in the hospital. I have been a visitor in the hospital. I have been a patient in the hospital. And I got up to my room 15 minutes after having a hip replaced or a knee replaced, and I was on the phone sponsoring. I don't give a damn what is going on. I don't care. If you are a compulsive overeater, you got one way out, and that's through this program. If you don't have a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, you are not going to recover. And what this person is showing me is they are not serious about their recovery. I'm not heartless. I'm not saying, I hope your son-in-law, whatever. I'm not saying anything about that. I don't care what your scenario is in the hospital. You've got 20 minutes to 30 minutes to talk to your sponsor. And you know who you talk to when you're in the hospital, or you're the patient, or you're the visitor? You talk to who you want to talk to. I guarantee you that if you were somebody that she wanted to talk to, she'd find the time to call you. She'd find the time to talk to you. What does it say on the top of page 96? It says here, do not be discouraged if your prospect does not respond at once. Search out another alcoholic and try again. You are sure to find someone desperate enough to accept with eagerness what you offer. We find it a waste of time to keep chasing a man who cannot or will not work with you. If you leave such a person alone, he may soon become convinced that he cannot recover by himself. To spend too much time on any one situation is to deny some other alcoholic an opportunity to live and be happy. This person is screaming at you. This recovery that you're talking about, not a big deal to me. It's really not a big deal to me. Unless you really think of it in those terms, I think you're missing the point. The world does not come to an end for anybody because someone is in the hospital. We call who we want to call. We do what we want to do. And this person is hanging a billboard and hiring a skywriter that says, Herbert, this is no big deal to me. That's what they're saying to you.
Thanks for the question, Herbert. Okay, let's move on to Marissa. But before we do, if you got questions for Harlan, be thinking about them, because after Marissa, we'll take some more names. Marissa, go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Harlan. My question is very much like Christina. It's about surrender. And for those of us that find surrender, especially from the Webster Dictionary, like waving the white flag, we have a real difficulty with that. What advice would you give us? What step might it be associated with? Are there interchangeable words that may not rub us the wrong way? Or are there recordings that would give us a different perspective on something that we're really finding a difficult time with? And thank you for answering my question.
You know what's funny, Marissa? I've been around these rooms a long time, and I was a slave to food. My mother used to say to me, my zun, which means my son, you're a slave to food. You're a slave to food. You're surrendering to the Almond Joys. You're surrendering to pizza and French fries. Food was my bitch. I was food's bitch. Sorry. I was food's bitch. I did whatever the food told me to do. If the food told me to get up at 1 o'clock in the morning when the Chicago Police Department is on the radio begging you not to drive your car because the ice and snow in Chicago are prohibitive to safety. There I was driving down the street to get to the candy, to get to the cookies. I was food's bitch. And now, all of a sudden, I'm going to assert my independence and I don't want to surrender to anything. I'll give you an alternative word. Life-giving. Life-giving. Do the things you need to be life-giving to yourself. Let God in. Let God in. Let's go to the bottom of page 43. Once more, see, he's already told us this a couple of times. Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink, except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. There are several things that all alcoholics, Al-Anons, compulsive overeaters do, and they do them as natural as they breathe. They lie to themselves and others. They keep score in their relationships. They assign blame, and they fight battles that don't exist. Stop fighting battles against the word surrender. Stop fighting battles about waving the white flag. This is not a dress rehearsal. This is not a dress rehearsal. This is it. This is your life. We don't get to come back and do it again. We don't get to come back and right the wrongs of the life that we're leading now. This is it. Call it surrender. Call it compliance. Call it life-giving. Call it what you want. Earthworm, if that works for you. But the one thing I would say to anybody that is afflicted with this disease is get out of your own way, Harlan. Get out of your own way and stop worrying about words and concepts of waving the white flag. And understand above everything that the main object of this book is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. And if that's the main object of this book, that damn well better be the main object of my life. I don't care what they call it. My way ain't working. My willpower, my diets, my way of dealing with things aren't working worth a damn. So call it surrender or not. Call it life-giving action. Call it whatever I want to call it. I don't want to talk about you. I'll talk about me. Marissa, I've got to get out of my own way. Who cares if they call it a camel, an earthworm, or a lamb? As long as I can live free of this compulsion, and there are millions of other people, millions, not thousands, not 100 like there were at the beginning, millions of other people that attest to this fact. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. What am I talking about here? I'm going to worry about a word? I want to worry about my action. Call it Fred if you want to. Call it Sam. Call it whatever you want to. I want to recover. I have been dead. I am back from the dead. I am back from the dead. I have been reborn in this program, and now I'm alive. I can get in and out of a car. I can bend down and pick something up. I walk 3 miles a day, 6 days a week. My numbers at my cardiologist, which I'm going to tomorrow, I have a cardiology appointment tomorrow, and I have the nutritionist right after that. My numbers are fantastic. My weight is good. My good cholesterol is going up. My bad cholesterol is coming down. My ejection fraction of my heart is over 50, and I'm 71 years old with plaque in my heart. My ejection fraction is over 50. My blood work is phenomenal. Is that what you want too? Is that what you want too? I've got 27 years of abstinence. So, Marissa, we got to stop fighting battles against words and stop fighting battles against anything else. This is the one life we have. Let's knock it off and let's do what the other people are doing that are in recovery. And if we do what they do, we'll have what they have. I hope that helps.
Thanks, Marissa. Hey, Harlan, is it true you threw a KFC chicken bones out of your car window?
I sure did.
On Lakeshore Drive?
Many times. I had to go make amends to the city of Chicago. And I had to go to the city of Chicago and say, I used to throw my McDonald's wrappers. Now, when I was eating heavily, McDonald's put everything in styrofoam packages. They didn't wrap it in paper, which is biodegradable. Now, everything was in styrofoam packages. And I would throw all that stuff out the window. I remember throwing chicken bones out the window. I remember throwing the bags and all that stuff out the window. I had to go make amends to the city of Chicago, and they said, okay, because they were saying, don't worry about it, don't worry about it. I said, look, I've got to do something. Let me work on the crew for a day, and I worked on the crew for a couple of hours. The guy calls me over. He says, go home. He says, that's enough. Go home. He says, no, that's good. You go home. He didn't want me working out there with the prisoners or the city workers or something. But, yeah, I was helping him out, and he says, just go home. But, yeah, I had to go make amends to the city of Chicago because I was an absolute litter bug. Absolute litter bug. Yes, that's very true. All right, we've got some time for more questions. Let's see what we got.
Give me your first
Diana
name
from Ohio.
Question for Harlan.
What
Janice
from Ohio.
Janice.
I can't get any of that. I hope you're hearing it. You're a little younger than I am, so maybe you can hear that.
Hannah Yetta,
we got. Okay, she's going to spell that for us, too. All right.
Freya
from Colorado.
Can you get that, Janice PM?
I did, Janice. Let me tell you who I heard so far. So the first person I heard was, hold on 1 second, was Diana or Deandra, something like that? And then Janice, Marissa... I believe Jeannie B, Hannah Yetta, and Freya. Who else?
Maura Z.
Gotcha, Maura.
Alicia S.
Alicia.
Priscilla H.
All right,
Nancy
let's stop with
J.
Priscilla. Let's stop with, I got to get Nancy in here. All right, here's who I heard, okay? So I'm sorry I didn't hear you. Something like Deandra, I believe Janice, Jeannie, Hannah Yetta, Freya, Maura, Felicia, Priscilla, and Nancy J. So let's go with that. Did I hear that right? Deandra? Did I get that? Or something close to Deandra? Or did I make that up?
Diana in Ohio, can I be heard?
There you go. Yeah, I can hear you. Go right ahead.
Okay, thank you. Thank you both for your service. I have a quick question. So going through the 12 steps quickly, I'm looking at Back to Basics, Wally P. Do you feel like that's effective for someone who is truly a food addict or a compulsive overeater, and is it my role to determine the effectiveness of the 12 steps if a sponsee has completed them? So I just have a question just about how quick going through the steps, is that ineffective, and just your opinion. Thank you.
The faster you can take them through, the more effective it becomes because of what's on page 89. And on page 89, it says, nothing ensures immunity from drinking like intensive work with other alcoholics. We don't have to have a PhD in the history of AA. We don't have to have a master's degree in Roseanneology or A.G. Ainsworthology to be sponsors. In other words, we don't have to know everything. We've got the rest of our lives to attend big book meetings. We've got the rest of our lives to learn things. One of the false things that they did in OA years ago, I hope they're still not doing it, is people would sponsor up to their level. And so if you had 3 days, you could sponsor someone in their first day. That is a very dangerous precedent, because the big book is very clear. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other alcoholics and practice these principles in all of our affairs. It doesn't say if you have 4 days, you can sponsor or someone with 2 days. What it says is having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. But I take people through it about 2.5 weeks. I get them through the steps in about 2.5 weeks. I don't abandon them. Now, this is a matter of preference. There are sponsors that once you're sponsoring, you're gone. You're done. I touch base with my sponsor every day. My sponsees call me every day. We have a 5-minute conversation. What are you going to do for yourself? What are you going to do for others? What are you grateful for? What's going on? And that's a very quick conversation. But I am a believer in giving very, very quick work to the steps. I don't give people 3 years to do their step four. I don't give them 6 months to do step four. I give them 3 hours, because there's nothing there that they don't know. They know who or what they resent. They know who or what they fear. They know who they've harmed sexually. There's nothing that they don't know. And the more time I give for step four, the more time it'll take them to let it sit on their desk. And what's eventually going to happen? They're going to eventually go back into the food, because the fear of it is going to overwhelm them, and they're going to eat. So I make quick work of this, and I believe that is the most effective way to do it. There are people chalishing on the line right now. They're fainting, thinking, oh my God, what is he saying to these people? These are my opinions based on my experience, based on my life. If you have a different opinion, you want to take people through in 6 months or 10 years, that's up to you. You're free to do what you want. I am not judging you. I'm answering the question. This is what I do. I get people through very quickly, and whatever it is that anyone else does is up to them. But I'm a believer in what the big book teaches me and get them through quickly. Let's just take one very quick example. Dr. Bob sponsored Bill Dotson, and he met him on June 26th, 1935. Now, Dr. Bob really got sober on June 17th, but okay, let's just go with the June 10th. That's 16 days after getting sober. And Bill Dotson was not the first person he tried this with. They tried it with 2 other people before meeting Bill Dotson. How many of your sponsees are sponsoring within 16 days? That's what you look at. These guys were sponsoring very, very quickly. It's all over the book and the stories. So that's my answer to that question. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks. Okay, we'll move through. Next up, Janice, followed by Jeannie. Janice, good morning.
Well, good morning to you, Larry, and of course, good morning. What did you say?
I lost you for a second there, and now you're back.
Oh, okay. Could be my phone. All right. I was very happy to hear, and I identified so much with the little story that you told about your daughter. How she felt, you know, how she must have felt. I don't know how she felt, but when you told us the story that she didn't want you to go to school. Now, can you tell me, give us some of your experiences for today that has gone on with these changes to rebuild a relationship with your daughter, your family, in recovery? Can you do that?
Well, if you're asking me specifically about my daughter and my family, it's not a very happy ending. My daughter has chosen to eliminate me from her life. I have not spoken to my daughter in many, many years. My daughter has decided that I'm not the father that she bargained for. She doesn't want me in her life, and I respect it. I do make attempts from time to time to contact her, and she rebuffs them. What has happened in my life, though, is that my relationship with God, my relationship with friends, my relationship with myself has exponentially gotten better and better and better. I have a beautiful relationship with my friends and a beautiful relationship with the people in my life. I find that in the last years, the last 27 years of my life, because of my recovery and because of this journey through life, things have been revealed to me that I didn't even know needed my attention. Recovery is like the disease in this respect. It is progressive. And the things that happened to me in my first years of recovery were don't eat, go to meetings, don't eat, go to meetings. And that's the march, don't eat, go to meetings, don't eat, go to meetings. And that's all well and good. What starts to happen as the years roll on, you start to see how dishonest you are with yourself about certain things. You start to see that you were a chameleon, that you were being dishonest with other people, if you're me, that if you were a Republican, I was a Republican. If you were a Democrat, I was a Democrat. If you liked red Oldsmobiles, I liked red Oldsmobiles. And I can't live that way for very long and stay out of the food. I cannot live a life based on lies. I have to live a life of honesty. I like blue, I like red Hondas, and I like blue Toyotas, or I like whatever. Whatever it is I am now comes to the surface, so that when I'm shaving, it's my face I see in the mirror and not yours. I don't have to compromise who I am. I don't have to compromise what I am so that you won't leave me and you will like me. I want you to like me. I hope you do. If you don't, oh well, unless I've harmed you, life goes on. If I've harmed you, I'm going to make amends. My daughter doesn't care to speak to me. My daughter doesn't, and that's fine. You know what? I wish her well. I hope God is good to her. I hope God is good to my child. She's a beautiful, beautiful child. The choices that she has made, they are right for her. I think they're incorrect choices, but they are good for her. This is the choices that she has made. I am the person today that God intended me to be. I speak my mind. I am on 2 feet. I am facing forward. I'm embracing life. And I am never more than a few minutes away from saying these words every day. How can I best serve thee? Thy will not mine be done. And the most precious words that come out of my mouth every day. Thank you, God. Thank you, God. Because come what may, and there are trials and tribulations of life, I trust God implicitly. That was not in place years and years ago. I didn't have the kind of relationship with God and people that I was proud of. I had a relationship with people that was based on BS. I was just being who they wanted me to be and doing what they wanted me to do so that they wouldn't leave me and abandon me. I can't live that way anymore. I know I'm repeating myself, but it's very important. And so my daughter doesn't speak to me. It hurts my heart. It hurts my heart. It's a wound, a gaping wound in my soul. I love this child, but I have to live with what is. I have to practice acceptance. I have to know that I don't know what's good for me, and if I don't know what's good for me, then I don't know what's good or bad for you or for anyone. Maybe it's not okay for my daughter, Hannah, to have a relationship with me. Maybe there are things that I'm unaware of that she just finds painful. I accept her and I love her. I give her to God. I give her to God. And that's what I do today. So my relationships are good. My relationships are honest. My relationships are solid. I don't lie to myself and I don't lie to others. Yeah, I'm this and I like red Oldsmobiles. Hell, they don't even make Oldsmobile anymore. But I am who I am. I'm like Popeye the Sailor Man. I am what I am and I'm honest, and that feels better than food ever could. All right, we're almost out of time here, so let's, Janice, I got to let this one go, but I wish I had a happier story on the family front. I don't. My wife came into the kitchen on May 16th, 2010, and told me she had fallen in love with somebody, and she wants out of our marriage. and she's with that person today, and they're very happy, and God bless them. And you know what? God bless her. God bless her. Okay.
Thanks, Janice. Okay, we're not going to get through all these, but we'll try to go do the best we can. Next up is Jeannie, and then we'll see from there. Jeannie B., good morning.
Hi, thank you very much. So I was wondering, Harlan, I hear your name and people speak of you and laud you and put you on a pedestal with great regularity. And I am wondering that how you try to tell yourself and them and how you handle it that it's not in your best interest or their best interest. So I'm wondering how you handle that, please.
I ignore it because to take that in is not good. That's not good for me to take in. I just pretty much ignore it. I urge anybody to know I am human. I have foibles and faults, and I have pain, and I have scars all over me. Put God on a pedestal. Don't put me on a pedestal. Put God on a pedestal.
Thanks, Jeannie. Okay, Hannah, yet to your turn, followed by Freya.
Okay, and Larry. Good morning, my friend. it says on page 87 in Upon Awakening.
Okay,
the first full paragraph. It says, we especially ask for freedom from self-will and careful not to make any requests for ourselves. Well, and it does go on to say that we shouldn't be selfish and everything else with that. But that sentence itself, in Judaism, we are told... What?
That sentence is what, Hanayata?
Okay, just that sentence. In Judaism, we are told that we are to pray for ourselves only. Now, of course,
do what's best for you. Do what you want to do for yourself.
Okay, so anywhere in there, if it's something that disagrees with your, you know, religious background, your
do what
team,
you need
whatever
to do.
It is.
Yep. Do what you
need
to
do. Okay.
Yep.
And
if it's working for you, do it.
All right, because 95% of this book comes from the Torah anyway. But anyway, okay. Love you guys. Oh, and my name is Hanayata.
C-H-A-N-A. Y-E-T-T-A-R from Plano, Texas. All right.
Freya. It's your turn, Freya.
Freya, Boulder, Colorado is in the house. Okay,
hey,
what's
good
up,
morning.
Freya?
Hey, it's Freya, very grateful, recovered in Colorado. I'm going to go to page 17 where it says, we have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. That's a beautiful ideal. Mm-hmm. However, it's not often what I experience. It seems like people have all kinds of opinions about how these directions should be interpreted and approached and implemented. And so I feel like there's a lot of disagreement. So how do you... I guess I would welcome an opinion and maybe like, how do we practice that ideal of
agreement?
Well, this
is agreement? Part of what's blowing us apart. This is part of why you have 19 programs today that are active in food addiction, 12-step programs, 19 of them. The original alcoholics, the 60 alcoholics at the beginning, all were in agreement. They were in lockstep with what worked. At first, they weren't. They went through a period of time where this guy was abstinent, so everybody did what he was doing, and then he would get drunk, and so they'd go over here and they would do what this guy's doing. When the book came out, it codified our program of action. It codified what we do. The problem is that not only at OA level itself, but the nature of the people that suffer from this addiction have factionalized it to the point of absurdity. One group says you got to have 90 days to speak in a meeting. Another group says when you first come in, the best thing you can do is share. One group says that you cannot share in this meeting unless you are sponsored in this meeting. And another group says you can share as long as you're a member of Overeaters Anonymous. One group uses this gray sheet. One group says no gray sheet. So we have factionalization within the ranks of the people who are afflicted with this disease. The one thing that helps me, and I don't know if it's going to help anybody else, I completely ignore the nattering of all the other factions. I completely ignore anything that is not justifiable in the big book of AA. Now, there was a movement afoot years ago, and there's still a movement afoot within AA to get rid of the big book. There was a vote taken not long ago, proposed by a trustee. And that trustee put it to the group that we decertify all AA literature from OA. And there are other factions within OA that say other different things. For me, and Freya, I don't know about you, for me, if it's not in the big book, I completely disregard it. I completely disregard it. I have recovered by following the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, with the exception of the paragraph that tells me to put chocolate next to my bed at night, and I don't remember the page that that's on. I want to say 113 or something like that. There's a paragraph that says you should put chocolate near your bed. I'm not doing that. But other than that paragraph, there's not a word, there's not a punctuation, there's not a inference in this book that does not apply to me 100%. So I keep it simple and I make it fun. Keep it simple, make it fun. I follow the big book, and that's what I do. And the nattering and the braying of all the other mules is good for them. It's fantastic for them. I completely disregard it.
Freya, thanks
so much. I hope that helps.
Okay, well, I think we're going to end with one more question from Maura.
Maura is a Yankees fan. No. Maura is a Yankees fan. So I love Maura. I truly do. I love Maura Z, or Maura Z, as she's known by in her Canadian circles. But she is a Yankees fan, so I disregard that completely. Maura, what do you got? Knowing I love you.
And I'm damn proud of it.
P.U. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Maura Z, and I'm gratefully recovered, and I thank you both for your service. I've got a quick question. I don't know if it's a long answer, but it's a quick question. On page 68, in the third paragraph.
Hold on. Give me a second here. My old fingers are arthritic. Okay. 68, third paragraph, 1, 2, 3. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator.
Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. Mm-hmm. I have a hard time working with sponsees over trying to get them to answer that question and not he would have us do.
Well,
do you have any guidance on that?
By doing, you become. Your will is your thinking. Your life is your action. Now, if you continually tell the truth, you'll be known as an honest person. If you continually lie, you'll become a liar. So what you will be is either a liar or an honest person. If you decide that this word be is not working for you, explain it this way. To be something, you must do something with chronic regularity. I walk 6 days a week. Now, I'm not going to be doing it in L.A. I'm going to take those days off and just relax and listen to Vision in the morning and, you know, whatever. But I'm going to take those days off. But I walk 6 days a week, 3 days, 3 miles a day, 6 days a week. And there are people in this neighborhood that will see me at the grocery store and says, "You're the guy that walks real early in the morning, aren't you?" That's what I am. That's what I do, so I become that. To be something, you are doing something with regularity. And that's all that means, is what do you need to do to be something? Do it regularly. Establish that credibility. And if you'll do that, you'll be fine. Does that help?
Thanks, Maura. Okay.
Thanks,
Harlan. Well, Harlan, yeah, thanks, Maura. Harlan, we're going to wrap up. We're so appreciative of your time. Let me give the share ID number for Harlan's presentation this morning and for the Q&A session here. That number is 23,084. That's 23084. And we're going to get Harlan's contact information in case you want to reach out to him. Look, the guy never gets any calls. He's lonely out there. Ring him up all day long. We'll get his phone number for that. So, but after the recording ends. So I'm going to read from our namesake here in the chapter called A Vision for You on page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. Obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.